From the Land Grant University at Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 31st day of March, 2017. It's USDA Report Day. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about those reports and the impact on the commodity markets in Chicago with Mike Zuzulo, a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. And if you can stay with us for the whole hour on our home radio station, tomorrow morning on many of these other radio stations, and later this afternoon at willag.org, willag.org, you can hear Commodity Week with our panelists this week, Bill Gentry, Joe Vaklovic, and Chip Nellinger. Stay with us for the first half hour of the program, because as we wrap up our time together there, we'll talk about the weather forecast too, that with Eric Snodgrass from Agrible. He says the drought monitor from USDA this week didn't take into account about 3 days worth of rainfall. That's really worth noting, and we'll do that right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Let's recap what the numbers look like in Chicago, or rather in Washington, D.C., as they were released from the United States Department of Agriculture for the afternoon. This prospective plantings report shows U.S. Corn farmers will put 89.996 million acres in the ground. That's 96% of last year's figure. Soybean number is 107% of last year's figure at 89.48 million acres. All wheat at 46.059. That's 92% of last year. Looking at the grain stocks numbers, corn on hand now at 8.616 billion bushels, soybeans at 1.735, and wheat at 1.655. Here to make some sense of those numbers and the impact they have had and may continue to have in Chicago is Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Good afternoon to you, Mike. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Todd. I hope we can make some sense out of them.
Well, we probably ought to start with the soybean number. It was bigger, actually, than not everybody in the trade, but on the larger side of what the trade thought would be put into place.
Yes, and I think this is where, as you say, it wasn't bigger than the highest trade guess, but it was right there with it. But fortunately, that excludes us from having a bombshell bearish report. And that was, I think, very, very big issue for the trade, very worrisome, especially given the South American crop private estimates going higher and higher and higher this week with fresh numbers out from AgroConsult Thursday afternoon, pushing us up to 113 million tons in the Brazilian crop. So it was very needed, I think, that we didn't get any kind of bombshell bearish report in the soy complex, especially. It still looks tough technically, and I think this is where the beans really do need the help of the wheat and the corn, the crude and the dollar to not continue to slide. But I will say this, and this is probably something many have not considered, and I still haven't considered it fully because it just happened today. But out here in the Western Corn Belt, Western Bean Belt, we've talked about on your show this 85 to 90 cent under basis in the beans. Well, because of that 10-19 base price for the crop insurance, someone carrying 85% bean crop insurance out in this part of the country is now almost fully protected with their revenue guarantee because that base price is off the November futures, whereas how you figure your revenue guarantee or your indemnity is based upon the crop you sell, price you sell at the cash, so it incorporates that horrible basis. Does this bring some support to the bean market because you've essentially insulated the Western Bean Belt, Western Corn Belt now at this point from a further price declines? And clearly our state of Kansas jumping 950,000 acres versus last year in beans. And now we're going to plant, based upon today's numbers, the same number of acres of beans as Ohio. Then I don't think there's going to be a lot of Kansas farmers that sell beans at this price if they go lower. Doesn't mean we have a low in place, but it is something we haven't had to deal with for many, many years this early. So it'll be interesting to see the dynamic at the Board of Trade.
Wait, let me think about what you just told me. So essentially you're telling me that because of the crop insurance and the increase in acres, you're not talking about another increase in acres. You're simply saying that they won't sell soybeans at least ahead of schedule, because their expectation will be that crop insurance will fully recoup them on their revenue? Is that what I heard, or is it?
No, that's exactly right. You're guaranteed at 55 bushel APH and a 1019 base price off the November futures at 85%. You're guaranteed about $475 an acre. Well, our cash price is now down to about $866 out here because of the terrible basis that we're talking about. And so you're at $475 an acre if you get 55 bushels. So you're exactly right. It doesn't mean we're going to go. In fact, I don't think we will have bigger bean acres unless Mother Nature forces us into it. But I do think that the producers will be very cautious about moving any cash sales. So what does this mean? Well, if the producer sticks mainly with paper positions like puts or short futures, that means the elevator's not getting the business. So the elevator doesn't have to go to the Board of Trade after locking in physical bushels with the producer because the producer's not selling. The elevator then does not have to go to the board and hedge it and sell the board. So this is, a dynamic that I'm thinking through right now, but of everybody I've talked to today, very few have thought about it. And it's one of those things we just haven't had to think about for a few years because the bean price has been so much higher. And we haven't triggered, essentially, the revenue guarantee this early in the crop year.
Supportive now until harvest?
No, I think what we're going to need, again, is the meal technicals to come in. I really think the meal is probably where it's at. I talked to my colleagues at EFG this afternoon after the report about the meal specifically, and they agree that there's a need for the meal to bring us support because the bean oil seems to really have given up at this stage of the course of the crop year. So I think if the meal technicals would find support around the $300 a ton level, then you could probably start talking about a medium-term bean low. But if we go cold and wet, which some of the models are supposedly starting to throw out in the back end, like the 16-day, 20-day outlooks, then you can't really get too eager about a bean low because then that makes me worry that the trade will think, well, maybe we'll even lose more corn acres just because of Mother Nature. So it's a very multifaceted market right now with the beans because there's so many different factors that are hitting it. Corn and wheat, thankfully, are a lot simpler. You're essentially going into the next week, a brand new quarter, a brand new month, with the trade thinking that we can get a 500 million bushel bean carryover, but it's going to be tough to get much over a 2 billion bushel corn carryover for the new crop year supply demand. And so this continuation of buying corn and selling beans is probably pretty likely.
And you said that Kansas, I just don't have the Kansas number in front of
sure.
me, for soybeans was 123%, right, if I remember correctly, of last year?
Yes, 950,000 more acres, and we're up to 5 million planted, and that's going to match up with Ohio, and we're only a million less than Indiana. And interesting because Iowa jumped 600,000 acres as well, and so I think that crop insurance price really, the producers knew it would insulate them because of the fact that it's the November board price that they're covering for their cash prices. So we did see that big jump in the West like we had been talking about on you and I and also on the Commodity Week programs the last couple months.
Yeah, so overall, for soybeans, damage is done. You're not thinking a whole lot more left unless it comes technically?
Yeah, I think what I'm getting at is that if the meal market can find support at $300, which is about $8 a ton lower, we should be carving out a low unless we turn wet and cold. And then we have to deal with an uncertainty that we haven't had to deal with, planning delays for several years, probably, 2009, probably the last time we really had to deal with any kind of planning delay talk. At that point, then you start opening up the downside in the meal. You start opening up the downside. You're essentially looking at 5-6% lower on both the meal and the bean prices. That's what I'm talking to clients about.
Sure, and all complicated by the stocks that can come out of South America. And Informa this week at 111 million metric tons. The number you gave us earlier was 113. On the flip side of that, corn from USDA at 96%, just under 9 of last year, and just under 90 million acres. That should be supportive, and was in Chicago for a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you also had the acreage number in wheat. You know, we've been talking about 46 million. We got 46.1 today. And I think between the wheat and the corn acreage number, I don't think the trade really bought into those numbers until they actually saw it today. So interesting dynamic in the technicals with the corn. You had December corn close above its 200-day moving average. You're now at the highest close since March 17th. and you had the May front-end corn close above 360. That is a low we had from, I think, around March 7th that we took out this week, and now we're back above it, and we're right about a penny from closing back above the 200-day moving average in the May corn as well. So you're getting really close to stimulating some technical buy signals in the corn and in the wheat. So my overall dynamic in this market is, if you took the planting weather out and we just came back next week and look at the technicals and look at the nearby fundamentals, if the meal holds, the wheat and the corn are probably what would bring a low in the soybeans, or some at least supportive feature to the soybeans. Not saying I'm going to take hedges off, but maybe we get a little bit of breathing room to be able to get a little bit of a short covering rally to get more hedges in place.
Well, thanks, Mike. Mike Zuzulo, of course, is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. In today's agricultural news, Sonny Perdue is still in the slow lane for the cabinet-level position at USDA, or Secretary of Ag. Perdue is now facing some fresh scrutiny on his nutrition record, or lack thereof, after the Senate Agriculture Committee favorably recommended his nomination yesterday. Chairman Pat Roberts, a Republican of Kansas, had clearly expected that Perdue would advance with unanimous support from committee members. But Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat of New York, logged her opposition during the meeting, citing concerns about the former Georgia governor's record on nutrition. That's a surprise twist that signals Perdue's path forward might not be quite as smooth as previously thought. Gillibrand could break recent precedent if she maintains her opposition during the floor vote. The senator, a rumored 2020 aspirant, has been opposing almost all of President Trump's cabinet picks. But the last time any agriculture secretary was opposed on the floor of the Senate was 1986, when Richard Ling had two no votes registered against him. Let's stay with USDA and on the subject of nutrition for a moment. After managing the nation's largest domestic anti-hunger programs, Audrey Rowe, who has put the Ag Department's Washington offices in her rearview mirror and moved to a rural part of West Virginia, but the former administrator at USDA's Food Nutrition Services, is keeping an anxious eye on what the new administration does next, especially in regards to food stamps. She says people who work in hunger and nutrition have deep roots and understanding in those programs and why those programs are critical. She says she fears that people coming in who may have very little knowledge about hunger and the depths of hunger and the causes of hunger and the ways in which can be best addressed will come in and focus on what she would consider to be more stereotypical ideas about why people experience hunger and food insecurity. Among the specific changes she believes are possible now in Washington, D.C., allowing states to drug test SNAP recipients. That's a practice former Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack successfully fought. Well, let's switch topics altogether and move to a decision made by U.S. EPA yesterday on chlorpyrifos. Louisiana Commissioner of Agriculture and Forestry Dr. Mike Strain serves as the president of the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture. He says the decision, which deals with the future of crop protection around the world, is in favor of agriculture, as it will continue to allow the use of the insecticide.
The National Association of State Departments of Agriculture applauds the U.S. EPA on a decision to decline a petition to revoke the tolerances for chlorpyrifos, which is an integral part of crop protection, including resistance management and integrated pest management in more than 100 countries. This is one of the tools that we have for crop protection. We commend the EPA for its decision that keeps this important insecticide available for farmers, because with this, it's an important tool. If we do not do this, it would cause a significant disruption in international trade. So again, as state regulatory partners with the EPA, we look forward to continuing to work with the agency to ensure current and future tools are reviewed in a rigorous, scientifically sound, and transparent method.
That's Dr. Mike Strain of NASDA, the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture. They submitted comments to EPA in January requesting the agency reevaluate its proposed tolerance revocations in compliance with the law and regulations that mandate a science-based review. EPA yesterday agreed with them. However, the Pesticide Action Network, North America, and the Natural Resources Defense Council are preparing to return to federal court as part of an attempt to force EPA to ban the agricultural use of chlorpyrifos. The groups which argue that the pesticide poses unacceptable neurodevelopmental risk to children are banking on the argument that the law requires the EPA to be extra protective of minors when it permits the use of pesticides. They're also hoping the judges won't accept another effort by the agency to delay a decision on the health risk of the widely used insecticide. And finally today, FMC Corporation has announced it will acquire a portion of DuPont's crop protection business that DuPont is divesting as part of its merger agreement with Dow. Additionally, DuPont will acquire FMC Health and Nutrition and receive $1.2 billion in cash. The EU, the European Union, agreed to approve the Dow-DuPont merger if the companies divested some assets, including research and development. FMC will acquire DuPont's global chewing pest insecticide portfolio, its global cereal broadleaf herbicides, and a substantial portion of DuPont's global crop protection research and development capabilities. After closing of the acquisition, FMC Agricultural Solutions will become the fifth largest crop protection chemical company in the world by revenue. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. Well, the U.S. House of Representatives has voted to reform the Environmental Protection Agency's Science Advisory Board. It's been criticized by agriculture for its controversial reviews of air and water regulations. An AFB, or an American Farm Bureau Federation official, complained during EPA's development of the now sidelined Waters of the U.S. rule that the agency seemed to be asking its Science Advisory Board to rubber stamp the rule. Former House Agriculture Committee Chairman Frank Lucas echoed a similar sentiment on the House floor last week as the body debated and then passed his bipartisan bill to reform the EPA board.
Some of the panelists have taken public and even political positions on issues they're advising about. For example, a lead reviewer of the EPA's hydraulic fracking study published an anti-fracking article called Regulate, Baby, Regulate.
Lucas says there's limited public input at board hearings, hearing records are incomplete, and that the EPA even pays some panel members, creating the appearance of a conflict of interest. He says his bill, that also passed in the House in the last Congress, is pro-science and pro-sound science.
This bill is founded upon recommendations for reform outlined by the National Academy of Sciences and EPA's peer review handbook. This bill ensures that the board is balanced, transparent, and independent, all of which will help prevent the SAB from being manipulated by any group.
House Ag Committee top Democrat Colin Peterson joined Lucas in co-sponsoring the bill, but most Democrats opposed it. Texas's Eddie Bernice Johnson claims the bill would make it harder for academic scientists to serve on the board, but easier for corporate interest.
This is accomplished by gutting actual financial conflict of interest restrictions against industry representatives. Under this legislation, those industry representatives would simply have to disclose their financial conflicts, and they could serve on panels directly related to their corporate interest.
Johnson charged the bill is designed to throw sand in the gears of the advisory board process, alleging it would have allowed the tobacco industry to co-opt the board in the 1990s in defrauding the public with bad science. Today, Lucas, Peterson, Farm Bureau, and others will make a similar argument about the environmental community and the existing EPA Science Advisory Board. This is the closing market report for Friday afternoon. It's the 31st day of March. We're now joined by Eric Snodgrass. He's from Agribull. A lot to talk about today, Eric. Let's get right into it. First, there was a drought monitor that came out this week, and I made note that it sure looked a little drier than I thought it should. Why was that the case?
Yeah, you know, if you could say one thing about March 2017 is that it's basically been a March with a whole bunch of lions and no lambs, right? And so we over the last 4 days, had a couple of very large systems that have come basically across the Central Plains over toward Illinois and Indiana. And not only has it brought a lot of severe weather, but it's brought a lot of rain. And the thing about that drought monitor is that that drought monitor is updated on Tuesday of each week, and then it's released to the public on Thursday. And what that means is that drought monitor does not include all the rain we got on the 28th, 29th, and 30th, and even some of the rain that's left over today. We had a huge section of the country that is currently in drought. So I think those central states, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas, Missouri, Illinois, where they got better than 2 inches of rainfall. Now, is that going to eliminate the drought that's there? No, but it's great rain that they desperately needed for that part of the country. And I'll tell you, that low pressure system that brought us those pretty nasty storms through Champaign yesterday, boy, we had some winds around here. Well, that low pressure system's on off to our north and east, and we're on the back side of it, which means we're getting some pretty strong northwesterly flow today. Pretty chilly, kind of bitter out there. And the thing is that we stand a chance tonight to get down into the middle to lower 30s. So, you know, just remember, our frost threat is really not over yet. Remember, April 15th is our mean date for the last frost of the season. So we've got some cooler weather to deal with in the short term.
What do we look like in those drier areas, the Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas areas, we move forward?
Yeah, so that's there's some good news in that regard. The kind of parade of storms that we've been seeing isn't ready to shut off just yet. You know, basically, we have on Sunday another system coming out of Texas into Oklahoma and Arkansas, dropping quite a bit more rain. So this is, again, great for drought. That's going to spread our way by Monday, Tuesday here in central Illinois. And then by Wednesday, we have another Colorado low that's going to move toward Iowa, again, bringing rain to that same location. But the only thing I'm really looking out for here is that, yeah, we're going to be wet. But when we get into next week, and so the next time we're talking, Todd, we're going to see what looks like to be a pretty large low pressure system that might be moving toward the Great Lakes. Now, this is not set in stone. It's kind of a long way off, but this is certainly something I'm watching. And if that system forms the way that it is currently forecast, yeah, it brings more rain. But on the backside of that system, we're going to get that northwest flow again. And there's a chance for below freezing temperatures, for North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, potentially Northern Illinois, and Southern Wisconsin. So just remember that April 15th date is our last day for a frost, and we're not even there yet. So yeah, we're definitely seeing that for the next week.
Hey, does that mean you think we might have a cooler than average April?
You know, overall, April's shaping up to look to be near average or slightly warmer than average. We really don't have a whole lot of cold air that's able to lock into place for the middle part of the country. Now, I have a whole different story if I was talking to you and we were in the northeastern United States right now. They have really locked into a cold flow pattern that's kept snow on the ground in Maine and Vermont, New Hampshire, and it's kept the northeast cool. But where we are, we're looking at overall a slight warm bias for the month of April. Doesn't mean every day is going to be warm, but we'll certainly see a warm bias. And the good news is, I'm looking at a map right now from the long-range European model, and it's suggesting, and has been suggesting, that we could remain wet for a good chunk of the Corn Belt, maybe a potential slight dry bias for the northern region, so think the Dakotas, Minnesota. But overall, this is good news considering what we've had in terms of drought in the central U.S. So overall, I think a pretty good picture to be painting here.
Thanks so much, Eric.
Yeah, thank you.
Eric Snodgrass is with Agrible, joins us on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.